after that. But no, Tony is such a good person. People will walk through fire for him, and I think that was the case before. I think it became public after the death of James that was the case. But he is such a unique and unusual person to be coaching an NFL team. You remember the stories of the Vermeils and the Joe Gibbs sleeping in cots in their office at night, and sure, trying to outwork the next guy, getting in at 5 in the morning and leaving at 11 o'clock at night. Tony Dungy still drives his kids to school every day, and then he goes into work. I mean, football for him is a job. It's not his life.
That was Rick Goslin from the Dallas Morning News from our show earlier this week about Tony Dungy. We're going to talk with Jeremy Schapp coming up in a few minutes from ESPN about his new book launching today, Triumph. Barnes & Noble has it on their website, about the life of Jesse Owens and the particular challenge and confrontation with Nazi Germany, the 1936 Olympics. I actually played in that stadium in the first football game on the continent of Europe in Berlin. And Jeremy Schapp is with us now. Jeremy, it's a big day for you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Nick. I appreciate it.
You know, they say that journalists don't do a lot of research. You know, the criticism is they don't go in depth. But this is a book that is a labor of love. But you went into great detail in this book, didn't you?
Well, you had to. I mean, the story has been so obscured by the passage of time, and it was covered so thoroughly when it was taking place. For me, it was really quite enjoyable. I love the research process. It's fun for me. I love kind of immersing myself in the old newspaper stories and the columns of the time and the magazines and the contemporaneous accounts of what was going on. Much like in the last book I wrote about Jim Braddock and Max Baer, there was so much colorful stuff written by the sports writers of the time. That was a great resource for me. And this story, unlike that story, is really broad in a political and social context.
Absolutely.
And all of it I found fascinating.
And heaven forbid we actually go into history and maybe learn something from the lessons of history itself. When we come back, Jeremy Schapp from ESPN, often somebody who co-hosts Outside the Lines, one of the more thoughtful people in sports, on his book Triumph, on the story of Jesse Owens at the 1936 Olympics and more. Stay with us.
If you think that you have to fight the crowds and long lines this tax season, think again. The Ronnie Deutsch Tax Center will prepare your tax returns over the phone. We could tell you how easy and convenient it is, but our clients say it best. Just listen.
No appointments necessary. You get on the phone as simple as A, B, and C.
I saved a lot of money doing it over the phone and quickly.
I knew that they were going to take full advantage of all the tax laws to help me.
It was fast and convenient, and they were very professional.
Just pick up the phone and call them. You won't believe the results unless you call them. They're there for you. They're professionals. They know what they're doing. Call them now.
Call the Ronnie Deutsch Tax Center today. We'll work hard to get you the biggest refund possible. Time to prepare tax returns and refund qualifications will vary. Services not available in New York or Oregon. Call now and you'll save 10% off our tax preparation fees. Call 800-923-3265. That's 800-923-3265. 800-923-3265. Call now.
Hi, everybody. This is Nick Lowry, and I want to tell you about the most beautiful golf course I've ever played. It's called Quintero. It's already ranked in the top 10 in the country as a real estate golf course. I'm telling you, it is the most outstanding combination of beautiful fairways and views you will ever see. If you want to join one of the most outstanding new private courses in the country, go to QuinteroGolf.com or call 888-417-8468. That's 888-41-QUINT or 888-417-8468.
What would you do with the extra money if you didn't have a mortgage payment? Secure your retirement? Pay for college? Invest in real estate? Travel? Is your home paid for free and clear? Or do you have a 30, 40, or even 50-year mortgage? Or worse, are you making interest-only payments with no reduction on the debt? If so, you're on a treadmill going nowhere fast. At United First Financial, we have great news. Our average client will pay off their 30-year mortgage in as little as 8 to 11 years, potentially saving thousands in interest. You don't need to refinance your existing mortgage. You don't need to make more money, and there's no need to alter your current lifestyle. Our Money Merge account can help you own your home years sooner, wipe out your debts, and have real financial independence. Our program works with fixed rate, interest only, and even NEGAM loans. This is not a biweekly mortgage program or a debt roll down plan. Again, no refinance of your mortgage is needed. To receive our free DVD, please call 800-300-1096. That's 800-300-1096.
This is Nick Lowry, and I'm here to tell you about HeadGamesRadio.com, the official website of Head Games Radio. If you can't listen to the show every day, just go to HeadGamesRadio.com and join the Head Games team. You get to listen to Head Games highlights from our superstar guests. As a member, you'll be entitled to exclusive offers and information, so register with us so we can send you updates and special giveaways that non-members just can't get. Stay tuned. Check out HeadGamesRadio.com. Email us and join the Head Games family.
Yes, I was fired. It happens to most coaches. Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to just lie there in the fetal position and whimper?
Welcome back with Jeremy Schaaf from ESPN, who's written a book, Triumph, about the story of Jesse Owens. And let's start first with the backdrop of the reality of the mid-30s in Depression America and what Jesse Owens had to deal with.
Well, I mean, you got to remember, Nick, Jesse Owens, at the time he goes to Berlin, is only 22 years old. He is the grandson of slaves. He is the son of an Alabama sharecropper. When he's 9 years old, the family moves to Cleveland, a significant improvement over the Deep South at that time for most blacks, but, you know, still a very, very segregated society. Some of the indignities that he had to suffer are almost unimaginable now. I mean, Jesse Owens couldn't live in a regular dorm at Ohio State University. He's arguably the most famous product of that school. He couldn't live on campus. It was hard, obviously, as hard as it was for everyone at that time to get jobs, to get good-paying jobs. It was much harder if you happen to be black. His family goes to New York to meet him when he's on his way back from the Olympics. They can't stay in any nice hotels, and the one hotel that will take them makes them take the service entrance in the back. So, you know, the situation in particular for a black man in the United States, even one as gifted and popular and successful as Jesse Owens, was obviously something today that is an embarrassment to us.
And the reality is Jesse Owens had actually tied several world records in high school, yet he was not even offered a scholarship.
Well, you know, it was complicated. There were certainly a lot of schools that wanted him. Athletic scholarships, as we now know them, did not as such exist back then. He had to take jobs to pay his tuition. By the time he got to college, he had a child back in Cleveland that he had to try to help to support. And considering how dire the circumstances were for most Americans in the mid-1930s, Jesse actually did okay for himself because of his athletic ability. He was he got a paying job at the Ohio State Legislature as a page. You know, they paid him, you know, $160, not a week, but over the course of a semester, which was not totally insignificant at the time, but such a different situation. We're talking about one of the elite athletes in the world, and he had to pump gas while he was going to school several hours a day and practicing several hours a day just to make ends meet.
And it's interesting that even then there were racy tabloid stories of romantic trysts and questions about... Tell me about the questions about the genetic advantages of black athletes.
Oh, well, this is at the very beginning, really, of the ascendancy of the African-American athlete. It's even, you could say, before it. Jesse Owens and his teammates, his African-American teammates, are the first large contingent of African-Americans to represent the U.S. at the Olympics. There had been a few in 1932, a few in 1928 and 1924, but the African-American track athlete takes over at the 36 Olympics. Joe Lewis is this undefeated heavyweight challenger, a phenomenon. Everywhere you look, blacks are coming to the fore in sports outside of professional team sports where they were not allowed to play at the time. So, pop anatomy lessons at the time suggested that, you know, there must be some inherent physical advantage for African Americans It was popularly thought that they had longer heel bones, which made them faster. It was thought that they had quicker response times naturally than whites. And Jesse, in the summer of 1935, after he sets a bevy of world records at the Big Ten Championships, this very prominent black physician by the name of William Montague Cobb undertakes all these experiments to measure Jesse's calf girth and the length of his heel bone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He was an anatomy expert. And this was covered nationally on the front page of the papers. And, of course, Montague Cobb, William Montague Cobb, proved that there are no inherent advantages. There is no difference. Blacks don't have longer heel bones. There's nothing like that to satisfy everyone's desire to understand why blacks were suddenly excelling in a way that they hadn't before. And the real answer was that they were finally getting opportunities to prove how good they were.
Well, let's move on to one of the great accomplishments of this book, Jeremy Schapp, which is to explode some of the myths about Hitler snubbing American athletes that were black and Jewish. Tell us what really happened in these Olympics. And also, wasn't there a boycott movement that has since been largely forgotten?
Well, yeah, the U.S. came very, very close, Nick, to not going to the Games at all in 1936. Germany had both the Winter and the Summer Games that year, the Winter Games down in Bavaria, the Summer Games obviously up in Prussia and Berlin. And for very good reasons, the U.S., there was a strong movement in the U.S. led by an Irish Catholic, New York City Democratic legislator and judge by the name of Jeremiah T. Mahoney. He wanted to boycott the Games. He was the head of the Amateur Athletic Union. On the other side was the head of the American Olympic Committee, Avery Brundage, who was very much for the Games and a fan, quite frankly, of Nazi Germany.
And he was in charge for right up until, what, the 80s, wasn't it?
Until 1976, Montreal. He goes from being the head of the American Olympic Committee to being the head of the International Olympic Committee after World War II.
And, isn't that a little frightening?
Very frightening. Well, Avery Brundage is best remembered probably for 1972 after the massacre in Munich, saying the Games must go on. I mean, a stunning lack of sensitivity to what had happened with the massacre of the Israeli athletes. But that was his character all the way back to 1936 when he campaigned quite aggressively to put the Games in Germany. And, you know, we have to look at it from the perspective of people in 1936. Clearly, it was apparent to anybody who was trying to learn about what was going on in Germany that Hitler's regime had evil intentions, that it sought to dehumanize its Jewish citizens and subjects. In fact, they took away their citizenship. But Brundage represented the school of thought that we shouldn't mix politics with sport, kind of ignoring the fact that it was Hitler who was mixing politics with sport. And, you know, you do have to remember, though, that in 1936, not even very few German Jews would have even predicted that Hitler would attempt to annihilate European Jewry. Clearly, he had bad intentions, but how bad, no one knew. And that only somewhat kind of mitigates the decision of the United States to take part in those Games, because the U.S. shouldn't have been there. The U.S. should not have in any way been legitimizing the Third Reich at that point, which is what those Olympic Games did. But of course, if
so, the reality is, even though this story that you're talking about does a lot to annihilate the theory or the ideology of Aryan supremacy, the reality is it did legitimize Hitler in a way that few other things could have.
No, there's no doubt about that. I mean, Jesse Owens goes to Berlin and he refutes the theory of Aryan supremacy, and to that extent, he embarrasses Germany. But you have to remember that that was not a surprise. Jesse Owens and his teammates were the greatest athletes in the world, and the Germans knew that the black American athletes were going to go there and win. There was no way they couldn't win. Taking that into consideration, they still thought that the Games would be great propaganda because it would give them an opportunity to display all of the good things that Hitler had done for a non-Jewish German society to that point. And most visitors, being rather naive and susceptible to the charms of the German propagandists, bought into that. Ultimately, I think as great as Jesse Owens' performance was there and everything that it meant, in hindsight, there's no way that the U.S. should have been at those Games.
When we come back, let's talk with Jeremy Schaff some more about a very interesting, curious, and powerful friendship with his German rival, broad jumper Luis Long, and what that meant and how that helped create some other realities in terms of relationships between blacks, between Germans, and what this Olympics truly meant in the canvas of history itself. We're talking about the book Triumph by Jeremy Schaff. We'll be right back on Head Games Radio on Sirius Satellite and Sports Byline. Stay with us.
Chances are you're paying too much for life insurance. So why not make a free phone call right now that could save you up to 50%, maybe even more, on quality term life insurance from Matrix Direct Insurance Services. Whether you're buying life insurance for the first time or cutting back on the cost of an overpriced policy, one free call to Matrix Direct is the simple and affordable way to get the term life insurance you need. Call Matrix Direct today, because chances are you're paying too much for life insurance. Here's the number, 1-800-471-TERM. The call is free, the quote is free, and there's no obligation. Call Matrix Direct now, 1-800-471-TERM, 1-800-471-TERM. That's 1-800-471-TERM. Call now.
Is credit card debt making your life miserable?
Are you tired of harassing phone calls and struggling to make ends meet?
You may qualify for a little-known program through Debt Consultants of America.
This program allows you to pay back only a small portion of the credit card debt you owe.
In fact, up to 60% of your credit card debt could completely be wiped clean.
It's a proven program.
The best part is Debt Consultants of America does all the work for you.
Plus, you don't have to pay back a penny of the debt that they settle for you.
So grab all your credit card statements and call for a free, no-obligation consultation.
Their friendly counselors will give you all the details.
Call 800-761-3480. That's 800-761-3480.
You need to have at least $10,000 in credit card debt to qualify for this program.
For your free, no-obligation consultation, please call us. 800-761-3480. Call now. 800-761-3480.
Sudden ups and downs, breathtaking twists and turns. No, it's not a roller coaster, it's the stock market. But it doesn't have to be a rough ride. Just subscribe to Barron's, America's premier financial weekly. Subscribe now and get 13 weeks of Barron's for only $39. Each fact-filled issue brings you investing insights, market information, and special reports you won't find anywhere else. Special reports that include the best-performing companies, mutual fund managers, and the outlook for stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. That's not all. Subscribe today and you'll also get Barron's Guide to Building Wealth, plus 4 weeks of Barron's Online free with your paid subscription. All the tools you need to make smarter investment decisions. That's 13 weeks of Barron's plus the Guide to Building Wealth and 4 weeks of Barron's Online, all for only $39. This offer is available to new subscribers in the continental U.S.
Call now, 800-828-2639. That's 800-828-2639.
There's 95 guys or 97 doing the right thing the right way and two or three jerks. So two or three jerks get 97% of the attention.
Join Head Games Radio. Call 800-878-PLAY. That's 800-878-7529. And now, here's your host, Nick Lowry.
Coming up, we're going to have Alan Schwartz from the New York Times about the dark days of hard-hitting NFL players and concussions, depression, and some of the new things that are coming out. We'll also be joined in a few minutes by Luke Jensen from ESPN. ESPN is everywhere, talking about the upcoming Davis Cup starting Friday. But let's get back to this incredible book, Triumph, by Jeremy Schaff, and two particular stories. One about the Jewish sprinters, Jeremy, who at the last moment were denied the chance to compete for the United States. Tell us what that was about.
Well, the plan had always been, since the trials in July 1936 in the U.S., that the guys who would run the relay, the sprint relay, would be Frank Wyckoff, Floyd Draper, and two Jewish sprinters named Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller. Of course, Marty became one of the great broadcasters, pioneering sports broadcasters of all time. On the day of the race, the first day, It's run over the course of 2 days, the 4x100-meter relay. There's a meeting at which the head track coach informs the team that he's changed his mind, that he hears reports that the Germans and the Dutch have been hiding their best sprinters, a statement that's demonstrably absurd. You can't hide world-class sprinters. And so he insists on putting Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf on the team, who are the United States' best sprinters, two African-Americans. What happens then has been told different ways over the last 71 years. Marty Glickman said that Jesse Owens stood up and said, "Coach, I've already got my three gold medals. Let Marty and Sam run." Jesse said that he stood up and said, "I've got my medals. Let Sam Stoller run," but didn't mention Marty. Ralph Metcalf, for his part, one of Jesse's closest friends, said he didn't remember Jesse saying anything. So it was kind of a he said, she said for a long, long time. The accusation by Marty Glickman and others was that anti-Semitism was involved, that Avery Brundage, who we previously mentioned, and Lawson Robertson were basically kowtowing to Hitler, did not want to embarrass the Fuhrer by putting Jews on the gold medal podium. That's possible. I think it's just as likely that the assistant track coach, Dean Cromwell, who is the USC track coach, just was protecting his guys, who happened to be Foy Draper and Frank Wyckoff, and wanted them to win gold medals. Regardless, what people haven't talked about for more than 70 years is the fact that Jesse lobbied to be on the relay after winning his three individual gold medals. And I'm not saying he didn't have the right to. He was the best in the world. Today it wouldn't even be an issue.
It wouldn't be an issue today.
So it wouldn't be an issue. At that time, it was kind of half and half. Sometimes the best guys ran, sometimes they didn't run in the relay. The U.S. usually won handily, so they figured, let's give all the guys gold medals. But for some reason, for more than 70 years, nobody's reported that all week long Jesse was saying, you know, boy, I really want to run and get another chance at that medal, which makes it, of course, much less likely that he got up in that meeting and offered to surrender his place on the team.
The idea is not a bad one, that he wants to make sure that they win, not only for himself, but for his country.
Of course. You know, and at that point, he is very upset with what the German press has been writing, calling the black Americans on the team the black auxiliaries, famously, suggesting that their victories don't count because they're subhuman. So he had every reason to be motivated to defeat them and to assure that victory. As it turned out, the Germans and the Dutch were no threat. The Germans didn't even win the silver medal. They won the bronze, and the Dutch were disqualified. The Italians won the silver. So Robertson's rationale was completely silly. But there's no doubt that today Jesse Owens would be running. That doesn't mean that Frank Wyckoff and Foy Draper should have been running instead of Stoller and Glickman. Wyckoff was, by all reports, Sam Stoller was faster than Foy Draper. And so the question really remains why Foy Draper ran and neither of the Jewish runners. But in terms of what Jesse was thinking, if he did stand up in that meeting, I have to think he either had a serious reconsideration and decided he wasn't going to be selfish, or he was just saying it to be polite, knowing that he wasn't really going to change anybody's mind.
Well, we're going to be joined by Luke Jensen in just a second, who always has an interesting perspective. But before Luke joins into this conversation, let's get to, I think, the most interesting story of all, which is the unlikely friendship that Jesse Owens struck up with his German rival, broad jumper Luce Long, and what that did for him.
Well, it's a great story, and I think unlike a lot of the other stories that have been passed down over the last 70 years, it's not apocryphal. Jesse Owens was the greatest broad jumper in the world, long jumper in the world going into these games, the world record holder. But in the qualifying rounds, he's having a hard time. He unintentionally fouls, if that's possible, on his first attempt, not knowing the German procedure that precluded him from taking a practice run. He fouls on his next attempt. It's a ridiculously short jump, qualifying level that he has to meet, something he's been doing for high school. But now he's down to one last jump, and he's getting nervous. Who comes over to him to give him some advice? None other than Lutz Long, the great German broad jumper, who was not Owens' equal, but he was as good as, he was probably the second best broad jumper in the world at that moment. And he says, "Jesse Owens," in his broken English, "what has got your goat? You're so good, this shouldn't be a problem at all. Just in your mind, put the takeoff point 6 inches behind the line. You're sure not to foul, and you're sure to make the distance easily anyway." Now, whether or not that conversation actually took place, and Jesse always said that it did, or usually said that it did, and certainly that's the legend. It's clear that Jesse Owens did take that advice or from someone and put it into his head. He qualified easily. Then in the final, he ends up out-dueling Long in this great back-and-forth competition, each of them breaking the Olympic record back-and-forth. Owens wins the gold medal with an Olympic record jump, and Long is the first person to congratulate him. And Long, you got to remember, Nick, he is the embodiment of the Aryan ideal. He's sleek, he's blonde, he's tall, he looks like, you know, Hitler's Aryan fantasy. And he runs over, he congratulates Owens, he grabs his arm, he parades with him through the infield right in front of Hitler. And then that night at the Olympic Village, they spend a lot of time talking, Jesse and Lutz Long, and they're from different worlds, they're from different socioeconomic backgrounds, black, white, etc. But they find a link, and it's a poignant story that's maybe the greatest story of friendship and sportsmanship, certainly in Olympic history.
And probably one of the stories that today would have been covered, but of course it's taken 71 years to come out in detail because of your book. We're joined by Luke Jensen. Luke, as you listen to the story of Jesse Owens, we've talked about Serena Williams, we talked about the interesting evolution of black athletes with you on the show before. Let's shift, if you will, Jeremy and Luke, to the subject of Tony Dungy and his accomplishment, looking back over the last 71 years, and of course the comparisons right after the Super Bowl Sunday night to Jackie Robinson. And in his usual humble way, Tony Dungy said, you know, I was a little bit floored by that, but when I thought about it, you know, it was fair to ask the question, even though I don't believe this is anything near that accomplishment. Let's start with Luke. First of all, buddy, thanks for joining us.
Anytime. Jeremy Sheff has one of the best backhands in broadcast history. If you ever play him, stay away from the backhand.
So, Luke, tell me what it means to you when you see a man of the character and the grace and the serenity, as well as the leadership and the intelligence of a Tony Dungy, what this means in the history of the evolution of the black athlete in America.
Well, I was very, very fortunate to be in the pro game and as a top amateur when the great Arthur Ashe in our sport transcended both race and the way you lead a group of people. He was my Davis Cup captain in 1984, and he had to captain guys like John McEnroe and Jimmy Connors and make all that work. His leadership, when I see Tony Dungy, the way he stalks the sidelines and how he supports his team and how he conducts himself, he reminds me so much of an Arthur Ashe. And I think leaders, doesn't matter what race you are, if you look at how Tony leads and how Arthur Ashe led his life and led his men through competition, that's the way to be a winner.
Jeremy Sheff, before we let you go, this is a fantastic book. I certainly am excited that it's come out, and I feel it helps connect us to the lessons of history which we so sorely need in sport and in society. But tell us what it means to you when you see the evolution of this history manifested in a Tony Dungy and a Lovie Smith.
Well, I think the thing that strikes me, first of all, is that at the end of the day, it was a nice story, it was a significant story, but it wasn't an epic story. You know, we were expecting this at some point. I mean, Tony Dungy could have won a Super Bowl 6-7 years ago in Tampa. There had been black head coaches in the NFL since the late 80s when Art Shell became the first since the days of Fritz Pollard in the 1920s. And I think Dungy ultimately is correct. This is not a milestone on par with anything, you know, such as 60 years ago with Jackie Robinson breaking the color line, but it is another step. It's an important step because it's kind of like what it means for Peyton Manning. You know, Peyton Manning finally got, you know, this burden off his shoulders. He's now an ultimate winner, and now black coaches can finally say in the NFL, hey, we can do everything. There's no reason that the league is 70% black, but there are only 6 black head coaches. That doesn't make sense. We win Super Bowls. We reach Super Bowls. It's time that we get the same respect as everybody else. To me, that's really the significance of it. And I think it can be a watershed moment in the way that it was a watershed moment when Doug Williams played so brilliantly in Super Bowl 22.
Well, Jeremy, we're going to let you go, but buddy, I appreciate it. And for all of you listening, pick up a copy of Triumph. It's a book about against the backdrop of swastikas flying, stormtroopers, an African-American son of sharecroppers sets 3 world records, destroys Hitler's myth of Aryan supremacy, but it's a lot more than that as well. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Nick, Luke, it's great talking to you guys.
Appreciate it, my friend. Hey, Luke, when we come back, let's get a quick update on the Davis Cup starting on Friday, okay?
You got it.
All right, when we come back, Luke Jensen with a quick update on the Davis Cup, and then we'll switch to something that Luke knows a little bit about with a father that played in the NFL, which is this interesting growing body of research on concussions and the consequences of careers hitting the hell out of human beings and being hit as well. When we come back on Head Games on Sports Byline and Sirius Channel 122, it's an important subject. Stay tuned.
When other people say, sorry, sold out, Tickets Now says, where would you like to sit? You like to control your own destiny. You do what you want to do, and you go where you want to go. Why not sit where you want to sit? Tickets Now has the choice seats for every major sports, concert, and theater event in North America. From the 50-yard line to orchestra seats to courtside, Tickets Now has the seats you really want. With Tickets Now, buying tickets is easy. And each transaction is backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go to TicketsNow.com today, where the words sold out are not a part of our vocabulary. TicketsNow.com. That's TicketsNow.com. TicketsNow.com. TicketsNow.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Nick Lowry, and I want to tell you about the most beautiful golf course I've ever played. It's called Quintero. It's already ranked in the top 10 in the country as a real estate golf course. I'm telling you, it is the most outstanding combination of beautiful fairways and views you will ever see. If you want to join one of the most outstanding new private courses in the country, go to QuinteroGolf.com or call 888-417-8468. That's 888-41-QUINT or 888-417-8468.
How would you like to make a full-time income working from home? Now you can with the proven work-from-home system at homebiz47.com. That's homebiz, the number 47.com. Order your free work-at-home training package today. See how you could spend more time with your family and earn more income than you ever imagined.
Life is absolutely amazing now. I have a business that allows me to be a full-time stay-at-home mom. I can work from home and actually bring in a six-figure income. My husband will be retiring. I have corporate America in a few short months at the age of 36 and be coming home to work with me full-time. And our daughter will have both parents at home, which is absolutely phenomenal.
Order your free work-at-home training package and free DVD by logging on to homebiz47.com. Shipping is not included. Change your life. Log on to HomeBiz, the number 47.com. That's HomeBiz47.com.
Keep the adventure in your travels, not your drinking water. Go ahead, take the road less traveled, because now you can have purified drinking water anytime, anywhere, just by packing a simple 8-ounce tool. SteriPen is compact, chemical-free, and kills over 99.99% of all unhealthy organisms in your drinking water within seconds. SteriPen is simple to use, so you can enjoy the journey and the drinking water. Available at REI stores everywhere, or go to REI.com. SteriPen, safe drinking water anywhere.
It takes the same thing to get to the Super Bowl and win that it takes to get there and lose. You know, it's not the NBA where you got a 7-game series once you get in that in the final. You got to get it done that day.
And now back to Head Games Radio with Nick Lowry. Join the conversation now by calling 800-878-PLAY. That's 800-878-7529.
Back from down under, it's Luke Jensen. Luke, appreciate you joining us for a few minutes. Just give us a quick update on the Davis Cup, something that is a different kind of tennis, a lot more exciting for those people that have been fans and sat in the stands. Tell us about what the U.S. team is going to do and its chances. It always seems to fall short in the Davis Cup.
Yeah, you know, Patrick McEnroe hasn't won. He's been to the final. He's been to the semi. He was in the semis last year. It's the tennis version of really the Olympics, where, you know, nation versus nation. It gets very emotional, gets very loud, very similar to a college atmosphere, but you're wearing your country's uniform. You're wearing their flag on your sleeve, and you're representing more than just yourself. Patrick McEnroe has maybe the most talented team right now in the world. He's got Roddick, who's, I think, four in the world right now. He's got James Blake. I think he's 5 in the world right now. And the number one doubles team in the world in the Bryan brothers. So he's got the talent. They just need to get over that hump, prepare a little sounder. They play the Czech Republic. And if you want to see the future of this game, the next, you know, Roger Federer, this guy Tomas Berdych, this 19-year-old whiz kid from the Czech Republic who can kind of do it all, 6'4", runs a really fast around the court, very tough mentally. And so we're up against a good, talented Czech team. But if you check OLN this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you're going to see some good matches.
Well, listen, give us your prediction, and maybe we can check in with you on Friday and get a little bit more about Tomas Berdych and the U.S. team. But what's your prediction? What are our chances, given that the U.S. has not had the kind of focus where the players come together for long enough to develop that camaraderie and that focus?
Well, the training hasn't been there, but we do have individually the players and the pieces to do it. First off, we finally have a doubles team for the United States side in the Bryant brothers that can dominate. The Czech team knows going into this tie, they're basically down one love. The Bryant brothers, I think, are 8-1 in Davis Cup play. They're outstanding in this format. They've played at Stanford, won a national title, both as a team, individual, and a doubles national championship. They understand the concept. So we go in there one love. Now, it comes down to how well Roddick's going to play and how well James Blake's going to play. If you look at the talent, we should beat the younger Berdych and the rest of that team. But Davis Cup is very emotional, and it's in the Czech Republic.
It's in Ostrava. Well, let's check in with you in a few days, my friend. Appreciate it. You're the best.
Hey,
you are the man.
My friend. You keep going for it.
Laces out, buddy. Luke Jensen. Well, now we're going to shift to a very, very serious subject, something that is a dose of reality, and one of the more thoughtful people that has been covering this first a few weeks ago, the tragedy, our friend Seth Joyner is going to join us because it cuts home very deeply with him, with Andre Waters. And we're joined by Alan Schwartz. That's Schwartz without the T. I've learned that myself. Alan, thanks for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
Alan, first let's start with the Andre Waters story and how you began to look into this more deeply. It's very troubling that a man at his age would have the brain tissue, and most of it seems to be linked to a history of multiple concussions, the brain tissue of an 85-year-old.
Yeah, well, for folks who don't know, Andre Waters was a very hard-hitting defensive player. I think he was a strong safety, if I remember correctly, for the Philadelphia Eagles during most of your career, Nick, you know, mid to late 80s and early 90s. And anyway, he committed suicide back in November, which is, of course, a terrible, terrible thing, and people really didn't know why. And, well, a fellow in Boston who was a former Harvard football player and later, of all things, a professional wrestler, well, he retired from his career due to concussions, and he became an expert in concussions. And he suspected, in the research that he had done on Andre Waters and his concussion history, that concussions might have impaired his thought process and exacerbated any depression that he might have felt and that afflicts everybody. Well, to make a long story short, he had pieces of Andre Waters' brain sent to Pittsburgh to a neuropathologist who discovered that, in fact, Andre Waters' brain had deteriorated to the point of it resembling an 85-year-old man with Alzheimer's. Now, is it possible that that's, you know, an exaggeration? Of course. But nonetheless, it was discovered that he had significant brain damage due to concussions that he had sustained on the football field, and research has shown that that type of damage caused by concussions can cause and or exacerbate depression to the point where someone might take his own life.
We're joined by Seth Joyner, who played with Andre Waters. Seth, this is a very personal thing for you, isn't it?
Oh, of course it is, Nick. No doubt. I mean, the guy was a good friend of mine, great teammate of mine. And, you know, it was really a sad situation.
When you hear that it can be this serious, Seth, how many other players that you knew during your career had to go to practice and go into a game not having fully recovered from a concussion?
Well, I think, you know, the way that trainers teams handle situations now quite a bit different than, you know, back when we played. You know, when guys get injured now, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, training staffs are looking to figure out a way, you know, to get the guy well. They really don't push many players back. It's just, you know, back when I played, they wanted you on the field. You know, if you were an integral part of what they understood they needed you to win. You know, most organizations didn't have a problem, you know, just putting the guy back out on the field, even if it wasn't 100%. There were many, many games where I played with injuries where I probably shouldn't even have been playing.
Did you ever play with a concussion, Seth?
No, fortunately, you know, if I ever had a concussion, you know, it wasn't that severe that it was an issue and I couldn't play or it bothered me. You know, I'm pretty sure I had one or two during my career and just really didn't realize, you know, what the heck was really going on. But I certainly have found quite a few guys, you know, you see guys, you know, have concussions and, you know, you look at them and you wonder, you know, well, what's the deal? You know, goodness, you just got a little hit on the head. You know, you've been sitting over there on the sideline for 2 weeks, but, you know, the more information, the more educated, you know, we've become about concussions, we understand now how severe, you know, they really are.
Alan, let's jump to the more recent article about Ted Johnson, the guy that led the Patriots defense to three Super Bowls. Certainly he was one of the key parts of that, and there seems to be a dispute over exactly what happened when he sustained a concussion and was encouraged over the advice of the team's trainer by Bill Belichick to go back into practice in the game.
Well, I got to tell you, there isn't a whole lot of dispute over it. I mean, I was expecting more than there has been. Ted Johnson, because of the story, and this sounds egotistical, but it's a fact, because of the story that I had written on Andre Waters in the New York Times, reached out to me and said that he wanted me to tell his story. His story is that in 2002, he sustained a concussion in a preseason game, and he contends that in practice 4 days later, when the trainer said that he should not be practicing in full contact, that Bill Belichick basically all but forced him to practice in full contact drills when he still was recovering from a concussion. Now, obviously, Ted Johnson was a grown man. He could have said no. But I think, Seth, you certainly can attest to the culture of NFL football where, you know, if you don't look hurt, you better get your butt out there. And if you say you have a concussion, you know, they're going to test you. And they're going to make sure that you know that, look, if there's any chance you can play, you better darn well play. Well, anyway, he sustained another concussion almost immediately. And as most people know or are learning today, if you sustain two concussions very close to each other, it can be incredibly damaging. And it damaged his brain to the point where he sustained a good half dozen more concussions over the next couple of years. And that has led to such damage neurologically in his brain that it's caused a significant depression, sleep disorders, attention disorders, just significant stuff to the point where his response to it, in part, was to become addicted to amphetamines and then also to antidepressants, which then, you know, put him on a roller coaster. He's been in a mental institution for 2 weeks, and he wanted to speak out not to single out Bill Belichick, but to say that this is the culture of football, that there is ignorance about concussions, and that more coaches should be aware what the potential cost can be if you rush or inappropriately induce players back onto the field. And
Alan, we had discussion about this before, and most people said that I was very disturbed when Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Roethlisberger was put back in after his second concussion, the first one coming from that motorcycle accident. The idea was said repeatedly that the best medical advice and a higher level of expertise actually was available to the Pittsburgh coaching staff, and that's why they thought it was okay. That doesn't seem to be the case, does it?
Well, I don't want to comment on the Pittsburgh situation. I don't have any specific knowledge with that, and I haven't talked to the people involved. The NFL has started what it claims to be a very coordinated and methodical committee that over the past 10 to 12 years has learned a lot about concussions, about how to treat concussions specifically in NFL football. They contend that if the symptoms of the first concussion have subsided to X degree, that the player can go out and play and continue to play in the same game. The evidence of this is that they report themselves that roughly 50% of players who sustain a concussion return to the same game. I will also say that there are many other independent medical committees and communities that think that this is insane, that think this is dangerously reckless, and that it sets a terrible example for college and high school and other types of organizations. That being
said, talk about Dr. Robert Cantu as well, and what he said about the status of Ted Johnson's brain and cognitive impairment.
Well, he said that already Ted Johnson, at the age of 34, is exhibiting symptoms of mild Alzheimer's, and that those symptoms typically do not abate. I believe his word was relentlessly. They continue to the point where probably 10 or 15 years from now, when Ted Johnson is 45 or 50, he might have full-blown Alzheimer's.
Seth Joyner, let's ask you what this means to you. When you know the culture of football, when you yourself had to deal with several times when you were advised to go back and practice and actually play with injuries, how difficult is it to turn around a culture that is so given to, you know, performance, to playing with pain?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, people need to really, really understand, you know, the football is a game, first and foremost, but, you know, football is huge business, you know, when you really get down to it. And there's so many more things that come into play, you know, when you talk about it. You know, sometimes guys are battling for their jobs, they're battling for position, you know, they got a contract year. There's so many things that come into play. And the problem is that you got an older guy, or you got a guy that maybe hasn't been performing, you know, he might sustain, you know, a concussion, and the next thing you know, he's being pushed to get back out on the field. I don't think that culture will ever go anywhere because, you know, you just have to face it. This game is built upon motivation. You know, you either get the job done or we'll find someone else to get it done. And if you're not healthy enough to get it done, well, you know, you're yesterday's news. I think it's very difficult to change that way of thinking. Not only do the organizations and the coaching staff, for the most part, you know, exercise that same type of thought, but the players know that it's that way, and they approach it that same way. But, you know, you get some players, you know, that are going to get a lot more leeway than other players just because, you know, their status and what the organization believes that they mean to their team.
Talking with Seth Joyner and Alan Schwartz from the New York Times, has written a series of articles, the most recent of which is Dark Days Following Hard-Hitting Career of the NFL. When we come back, Alan, let's talk about the believability of this so-called witness, Ted Johnson, how much he was held in respect, and if he says this, whether it was really the way it happened. We're talking with Seth Joyner and Alan Schwartz on a very serious subject: collisions, depression, even Alzheimer's following NFL careers. You're listening to Head Games Radio on Sports Byline and Sirius Channel 122. Stay with us.
Sudden ups and downs, breathtaking twists and turns. No, it's not a roller coaster. It's the stock market. But it doesn't have to be a rough ride. Just subscribe to Barron's, America's premier financial weekly. Subscribe now and get 13 weeks of Barron's for only $39. Each fact-filled issue brings you investing insights, market information, and special reports you won't find anywhere else. Special reports that include the best-performing companies, mutual fund managers, and the outlook for stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. That's not all. Subscribe today and you'll also get Barron's Guide to Building Wealth, plus 4 weeks of Barron's Online free with your paid subscription. All the tools you need to make smarter investment decisions. That's 13 weeks of Barron's plus the Guide to Building Wealth and 4 weeks of Barron's Online, all for only $39. This offer is available to new subscribers in the continental U.S.
Call now, 800-828-2639. That's 800-828-2639.
Available now from Doubleday Books. Real Baseball, Baseball's Golden Era, The Way America Witnessed It, In the Movie Newsreels. Author Les Krantz brings a celebration of the golden age of baseball through the movie house newsreels that once presented the game's great plays and players to fans across the country. Real Baseball is an enchanting look back at baseball from 1932 to 1965. This handsomely illustrated volume, with a foreword by Hall of Fame catcher Yogi Berra, traces the seminal role of newsreels in making baseball the national pastime before television brought the game into houses across America. This book also includes a one-hour DVD that features the most thrilling moments from original newsreels hosted by baseball great Joe Garagiola. Stay tuned to Sports Byline USA Broadcast Network for your chance to win a copy of Real Baseball by Les Krantz from Doubleday. Available now wherever books are sold.
Golf Digest is going to cure your slice now, and that's a guarantee. Introducing the breakthrough video, Cure Your Slice Now, and it's free with your paid subscription to Golf Digest magazine. In this video, top PGA instructor Chuck Cook shows you the seven key phases of the swing and gives you his proven method for better control and longer, straighter drives. And here's our guarantee. If Golf Digest and Cure Your Slice Now doesn't cure your slice and improve your game, cancel the subscription and keep the video free. Every month in Golf Digest, you get easy-to-follow instruction from the best teachers and players in golf, information on the top equipment, the best places to play, and you also get the removable Pocket Tips booklet. Call now. Use your credit card and get your first risk-free issue, the Pocket Tips booklet, and the video free. You get 11 more issues for only $19.77. If your game doesn't improve, cancel your subscription and keep the video, booklet, and magazine free.
Call 800-828-2639. That's 800-828-2639 for Golf Digest.
Welcome back. Tomorrow's show, we'll have Herman Edwards, the Chiefs coach, talking about his very close friend Tony Dungy and what this means, a tremendous accomplishment. And also in basketball and baseball, we'll have ESPN's NBA expert Mark Stein and the Oakland A's star Nick Swisher. Well, Alan Schwartz, this article with Ted Johnson, some would say, what is the motive for Ted Johnson? He actually says, I'm afraid of somebody else being the next Andre Waters. Tell us just how much of a credible resource is Ted Johnson?
Well, I think he's very credible. To be honest, I knew about this about 3 weeks ago, and I spent 2 weeks making sure, as many ways as I could, that his story checked out, to the point where Ted talked to the Patriots and, without being 100% truthful, secured his medical records in order to prove to me that that the injuries that he talked about took place. Of course, there was no proof about what happened on the practice field that day. That being said, a reporter from the Boston Globe, who checked this out as well, got confirmation from Roman Pfeiffer, who was a defensive player at that time. He said, yes, that this happened. And I checked out with some other people who didn't really want to speak publicly because they still play for Coach Belichick, who said, you can take Ted's word to the bank. Bill Belichick, when approached by the Boston Globe, he did not return my phone call, said that, he basically said, well, a lot of things happened back then. I don't really want to get into it. He did not deny it. He didn't come close to even sounding like he was going to try to deny it. Once again, Bill Belichick is not the only person who has done this type of thing. Lots of coaches in lots of areas have done the same thing, and he should not necessarily stand alone as he comes under fire for this.
Well, before we let both of you go, one final comment is that Ted Johnson was also worried that he was in a contract dispute and that if he didn't play, he'd be exacerbating the relationship that might further encourage the Patriots, who have done it before, to release him. So, Seth Joyner, final words in the last 15, 20 seconds. What advice would you give to players in the league today to make sure they're not the next Ted Johnson or Andre Waters?
Well, guys got to realize that their health is the most important thing. Football is just something that you're going to do temporarily. It's not you. It's not, your identity. Sure, it's a lot of money and it's a business, but, there's nothing more important than your health. And you've always got to do what's necessary and what's right for your own well-being, even if other people don't care about it.
Gentlemen, Seth Joyner, Alan Schwartz for the New York Times. Really appreciate it. Let's do this again soon.
You got it, Nick.
Appreciate
Take care.
Take care. Thanks, guys. Tomorrow, Herman Edwards, Nick Swisher of the Oakland A's, Mark Stein of the NBA. Go to Head Games Radio, headgamesradio.com, for all the highlights if you want to listen again. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.